Welcome. You're listening to Mark and Jackie's Wildlife and Photography Podcast. Explore and learn about the natural world and how to take pictures. This episode is all about wildlife and nature. Understanding the natural world is important. It's what makes life on this planet possible. Our podcast gives you insights into just how complicated and fascinating that world is. Episode 6, Spring. In this episode of our podcast, we're going to be talking about spring and the changes that brings to our natural world and to our wildlife. Now, spring is a phenomenon that we all take probably for granted, but we should only take it for granted if we live in a particular place within our planet. Because spring only occurs, really, in the temperate zones and the subpolar zones of our planet. If you go to the equator, for instance, you're unlikely to experience spring. But here in the Northern Hemisphere, which is where we live, springtime is normally regarded as between March and May, and it's been celebrated, the coming of spring, since probably mankind began. When things started to grow and the flowers came out and plants grew, we used to celebrate it. It's been a part of tradition and myth for many, many millennia. In prehistory, the celebrations of coming of spring were incorporated into religious festivals later on. The myths around the animals and what they do in spring still persist to this day. The common hare or brown hare has been a mythical creature for thousands of years. And in Anglo-Saxon times, the goddess of spring, Estra or Ustra, depending on how you pronounce it, is said to have had a hare as a companion. And the hares were associated with spring because they make a nest and they lay colourful eggs. Well, that's not quite true, but a hare only produces a form, which is a dip in the ground where its young are born. Now, this mythical creature laying colourful eggs has now been replaced. And today, we all celebrate the Easter Bunny, and we hide brightly coloured chicken or chocolate eggs for others to find. And many celebrations celebrate growing seasons or the start of a season. In Japan, for instance, there's a cherry blossom that comes out somewhere between March and May time. Now, spring as a season is an astrophysical phenomenon. By that I mean that it's a phenomenon of our planet. It is caused by a physical tipping of the Earth. If you could put a stick through the celestial poles, the north and south celestial poles, and then observe the Earth spinning around that stick, you would in fact see it's not actually completely upright. It's tilted at between 23 and 24 degrees off its axis. And it's this tilt that gives us our seasons. It gives you the seasons really in the temporal zones, and that's the zones that are just above the equator and go up to the subpolar in the far north. And as you move away from the further north, you from the equator, you'll start to experience seasons. These periods in the year are when the weather, temperature and light patterns change dramatically over the course of a year, and they define each of the periods of the year. For most of us who live in a temperate zone, we will experience four seasons: spring, summer, fall, autumn, and winter. Now, I know this all sounds a bit complicated, but it really just boils down to the fact that because our Earth is on a tilt, that at some points in the year, we're further away from the sun, and at other times, we're closer to the sun. And so in winter, in December in the Northern Hemisphere, we get less daylight and therefore the temperatures get colder and we experience a winter. Now, winter in the Northern Hemisphere is said to begin on December the 21st, the winter solstice, and it's the shortest day of the year. Summer begins around the 21st of June, which is the summer solstice, which is the day where there's a maximum amount of sunlight. And spring begins on the vernal equinox, or the spring equinox, which is March the 21st, 22nd, and it's the day that's supposed to signal equal day length. And autumn or fall starts on the autumnal equinox, September the 22nd to 23rd, and again, that's a day of equal length of day and night. Obviously, if you live in the southern hemisphere, it's all a bit different because the whole thing is a bit reversed. Because in the southern hemisphere, you would get your further away during the northern hemisphere summer. So winter, for instance, in the southern hemisphere is in June. Summer's in December. Autumn and fall is in March. And the spring would be in September. But that's because of the tilt of the earth. Four-season year is typical only for the mid-latitudes, as I said, not near the poles or the equator. And that is all because of day length. Take, for instance, where we live, which is Inverness, we're in the Highlands of Scotland. During winter, in December the 21st, we see about 6.5 hours of daylight. By Midsummer's Day, that number of hours has gone up to 18 hours of daylight. So for us, the seasons are quite different. Summer and winter can have vast changes of temperature. If you go to somewhere like Italy, Rome for instance, in midwinter, in December, it has about 9 hours of daylight. And in Midsummer's Day, about 15 hours of daylight. So at this latitude, you don't see much difference perhaps between summer and winter. If you get to the equator, however, that's always pretty near to the sun. It doesn't change very much. And the day length will change by only about 15 minutes over the course of a year. So near the equator, countries remain warm all year round. They do have rainy and dry seasons, but they don't have normal seasons as we in the northern hemisphere, living in the temporal zone, would actually understand it. Nearer the pole you get in these subpolar regions, the daylight changes are dramatic between summer and winter. Barrow in Alaska, one of the most northern cities in America, stays light all day long between mid-May and early August. But the city is in total darkness between mid-November and January. So if you live in part of the planet that experiences the four seasons, they have a big influence on the natural world. As spring starts, so does the growth of many plants and trees. It's accelerating through spring towards summer. It's awakening from the winter and the typical cold weather, where little daylight doesn't allow the earth to warm up. Take, for instance, the changes that we see just in our garden. We watch badgers most of the year, but come the winter time, we see very few badgers coming up to see our garden, or don't actually come to see the garden, they come actually to feed on peanuts. During the winter months, they prefer to stay in their set. It's that much warmer than the cold of a typical evening in Scotland. But as the weather starts to warm, we might see more badgers come up, maybe one or two a night, rather than perhaps 3 or 4 days without seeing a badger. If the weather has been mild in March, we start to see more and more individuals appearing. They come for a feed on the peanuts we supply. And by mid-March this year, we've had up to 9 individuals visiting us during one evening. Mind you, just because we haven't seen them during the winter, it doesn't mean that they've not been busy in their underground world. Badgers are a small group of mammals that use what is known as delayed implantation. Certain mammals, the embryo doesn't implant during the immediate period after fertilisation, but remains in a state of suspended growth. It's called the bioclast stage, or also known as diapause. The bioclast will be in suspended animation, but as daylight warmth, food availability starts to change, this will trigger the bioclast to implant. As soon as it's implanted, what follows is a normal gestation period. And in the bad case of badgers, the young are born underground. Diapause allows for these young badgers to be born when the most favourable conditions for their survival is about to take place. In other words, spring, there will be a plentiful supply of beetles and worms and other foods for the badgers to eat. In some species, embryonic diapause is mandatory, for instance, for them to be successful in their ability to breed. Seals, for instance, come ashore once a year to whelp. They will whelp, breed, and then return to the sea, and will not come back onto land for another year, and they are one of the animals that use diapause. We have three species of animal that visit our garden that all use diapause as a breeding strategy, and that, as I said, I've mentioned the badger, but also the roe deer and the pine martins that come, all use this particular strategy as a way of giving their young a good head start over others. Other species which use delayed implantation include things like the armadillo, bears, mink, the sea lion, shrew, and skunk. All these species of animals have found that this gives them the advantage when it comes to getting a head start in spring. Spring also sees, of course, the return of the leaves in deciduous trees. In autumn, deciduous trees will shed their leaves, and the reason is because they cost too much. There's not enough sunlight for them to produce the sugars that the tree needs, and they're quite an expensive thing in terms of energy for the tree to keep going. They're also, in very cold climates, in frosts, would be damaged. So what happens is, as the winter starts to come on, autumn is with us, the tree will shut down and shed its leaves. In spring, it's got to replace all the leaves that it shed during the autumn, and the spring will see leaves start to flush onto the trees. It's all triggered by day length and the warming earth. This change in temperature and light also triggers some plants to burst into flower, especially those flowers that grow under trees and in thick woodland. These species of flowers must flower and set seed while they can still see the sun. Because they grow under trees, as soon as the trees flush their leaves out, they'll no longer be able to get enough sunlight to be able to produce flowers. Here in the UK, perhaps one of the iconic flowers of spring is the bluebell. They're also found in the Western Atlantic Europe, and they've been introduced into North America. About 50% of the world's bluebells grow in the UK, and spring is the time when they burst into flower. Here in the UK, we have some ancient woodland that may have been growing with undisturbed for 200 or 300 years. And they're normally the places where you would find plentiful supplies of bluebells. They're called bluebell woods for that very reason. So come April time, there's a big carpet of the violet blue flowers. And they need to grow and set seed, as I said, before the leaves come. And at this time of year, they're probably one of the few flower species that are out and flowering. So they might be pollinated by any insect that's woken up early and is looking for nectar to feed on. And that's, of course, in a good year. In some years, the strategy may backfire. The flowers may be destroyed by frosts, or the trees might start to flush early and cover them up before they really have a chance to come into full bloom. Most of these early flowering plants have a backup plan. And that backup plan really is that most of them have a rhizome or a bulb underground. Some use root growth to actually propagate and go, but most of them have an underground store and a reserve. And what they can do is they don't need to set seed every year. They use their rhizomes and bulbs to multiply and get bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's why it has to be ancient woodland, because these underground reserves of food needs to be undisturbed. If you dig them up or disturb the ground above them. The rhizomes take a year or two just to recover from that disturbance. As spring starts to get underway, the shrubs and bushes start to flower or to produce leaves. And this is a feast for insects that will have overwintered perhaps as only an egg. And as the sun starts and the leaves come out, these insect eggs will start to hatch and the caterpillars will start to eat the leaves. It's also the time of lengthening days that other things start to think about reproduction rather than the just survival of winter. During the winter, the birds that haven't migrated to a warmer climate will have overwintered eating just seeds and the very small amount of insect that they can find. But this food is not super nutritious and it's certainly not going to support a clutch of chicks. What they need are the nice squishy soft bodies of caterpillars and other insect larvae that have been feeding on the leaves. Birds that have remained silent for much of the year will now start to sing, to declare their territories, to try and find a mate. Because this time of year, spring, is when you need to find a mate, build a nest, and start raising a family. Feathers will change colour. Now, some birds have a clever system, like ducks, mallard duck, for instance, where at the end of the summer, they will go into what's called an eclipse plumage, which is brown and well disguised to hide them in the depths of winter. Come springtime, they'll start to molt from this eclipse plumage into their full breeding colours. So you go from seeing very drab mallard ducks to very brightly coloured mallard ducks in just a few weeks. A lot of birds don't molt in the springtime. What they do is that when they molt back in the winter, their feathers have got brown or grey or certainly very muted colours at the ends of them, right at the end of the feather. There is just a band of very muted colours. And that, because the feathers are overlapping, means the bird can look quite drab during the winter. And this, again, acts as a camouflage, and it helps them through the winter to keep out of the way of a hungry predator. But as the season wears on and winter comes to an end, what happens is the ends of these feathers start to wear. It's a technique called abrasion. And as the feathers start to wear at the ends, what happens is that the brown and dark grey that was there is eroded back, and the bright colours that are underneath and have been underneath all the way since autumn starts to show. So when you look at birds in the spring, you think, oh, that's very brightly coloured. And they're the two ways that birds use to get into breeding plumage. It's mainly the males that get into breeding plumage, and it's all about impressing the females. Spring is also the time when most temperate zones see the return of migrating bird populations. About a fifth of the species of birds migrate. They travel vast distances from the south, where it's been warmer and where they've been able to overwinter. For instance, if you get a swallows or cuckoos that come back to the UK in the summer, they will have spent most of their winters in sub-Saharan Africa. And the reason for that is that they're insect feeders. They can't survive on seeds, so they need to go somewhere that's warm enough that will provide them with insects through the period of the winter. In the UK, this is the time of year we'll see the return of some of the iconic species. Things like ospreys, swifts, swallows, and house martins. But there's an enormous list of birds that migrate. Most of them are not as big as you would think. Even very tiny birds, only a few grams in weight, will make that long journey from warmer climes back to the UK. Because during our summer, there will be an enormous abundance of insects. Things like wheatear, chiffchaff, sand martin, sandwich terns, willow warbler, black cap, red star. Oh, the list goes on and on and on. It's the same in the Americas. The Americas have long-distance migration. Migrants will have come from Mexico or Central America even, and they'll migrate during the spring up towards the US and Canada. The migration in America features more than 300 species of birds, and over 3.5 billion individuals cross back into the US every year. And 2.6 billion birds return to Canada each year. They cross the northern US border. And all this influx of mouths is fed by the rising of the spring. The leaves and the flowers will provide the food that the insects need, and the insects will provide the food that the birds need. As I said earlier, we live in the north of the UK, and spring will have come early in the south. Places like London will already be warming. They may even be migrant birds coming in as we speak. Spring travels at a walking pace from the south to the north in the northern hemisphere. So it may take 4 or 5 or 6 weeks even for us to see the same flowers that are out in the south of England than here in Scotland. Spring is also the time when the smaller mammals will start to think about having families. Larger mammals, on the other hand, they will have probably bred late autumn last year, but they have a longer gestation period, so they can afford to breed late in the year, and then by the time their calves or young are born, it'll be coming up to the end of spring, when the growth of summer will have started, and there'll be plenty of food for the newborns. Although most herbivores will rely on the plant-based, spring and summer and the abundance of plants also triggers carnivores to start to think about families and breeding. No, they don't eat the vegetation, but what they do is they like to snack on the abundance of newborn animals, because there's now an abundance of food due to the growth of spring. Spring has been celebrated for thousands and thousands of years. It comes slowly and then will accelerate towards summer and the abundance of food. Plants and flowers will set seed. Birds and other animals will be rearing their young. It is one of the greatest miracles, I think, of living in a temperate zone that you see these changes happening before you. A tree that looked dead just a few weeks ago will have a change of colour. Buds will start to appear, ready to burst into leaf. The harsh, quiet winters, where survival is the main interest, to get over the weather, to keep warm, to find enough food. Those days will be gone, and a frenzy of new growth and new sound will start. It will herald the time of awakening of the spring. We hope that you've enjoyed this podcast. If you'd like to know more about our badgers, we have produced a podcast about badgers in our garden. My name's Mark Bloomfield, and thank you very much indeed for listening. You've been listening to a wildlife and photography podcast produced by M&J Bloomfield. For more information and details about us and our work, visit our website at mnjbloomfield.com. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us again soon. Hunnishin, mush and luck.